This episode of the Majority Report is brought to you by Igloo. It's an intranet you'll actually like. Share files, blog updates, coordinate calendars, and manage projects. It's easy to use and easy to configure, even for the most non-technical of users. And it also means that everything you can do at your desk, you can now do on the go, on your phone. Whether you're a large enterprise stuck using SharePoint or a fast-growing business overwhelmed by apps, you can create an intranet that matches your brand's look and feel. Check it out at igloosoftware.com/majority. You can try it for free. That's igloosoftware.com/majority.
You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
Well, I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, February 4th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live. Steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal, the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, David Dayen. On the proposed Obama budget and the proposed corporate tax amnesty. Also on the program today, looks like big win for net neutrality. FCC Commissioner Tom Wheeler announces today they are seeking to reclassify the internet as a utility. That's Title II classification. Devil's always in the details. Also on the program today, deeply embedded in that story about Chris Christie's affinity for luxury is a little tiny bombshell I will tell you about. It'll be interesting to see if it comes out in this campaign. Also on the program today, new senator from North Carolina, Tom Tillis, promoting fecals everywhere bill. We'll talk about the just more libertarian lunacy. Also, as predicted, well, I'll get to that. You're not going to believe the problems the right-wingers had with the Carnival Cruise Line ad over the Super Bowl. Tennessee Senate, Jesus wants people not to have health care. The EPA comes out and provides some cover for President Obama to reject Keystone based upon global warming concerns. Remember all that weaponry we gave the Yemeni regime? Looks like we lost it. Whoops. What are you going to do? And Jordan executes two in retaliation for ISIS burning alive one of its pilots. All that and more on today's program. Folks, one of the things that makes me sad about not having Mitt Romney in the race anymore in 2016 is that we don't have Mitt Romney in the race anymore for 2016.
And also he was in your draft.
Yes, that too. But even more so, it's just Mitt Romney, so Mitt Romney. And apparently in a forthcoming book written by David Axelrod, the former senior advisor to President Obama. Now I think he's an MSNBC contributor. I'm not sure. Apparently, Mitt Romney called President Obama to concede the presidential race. And over the course of the call, President Obama did not look at all amused. According to Axelrod's book, Obama was, quote, unsmiling during the call and slightly irritated when it was over. The president hung up and said Romney admitted he was surprised at his own loss. All right, of course, that's not surprising. Quote, you really did a great job of getting the vote out in places like Cleveland and Milwaukee. In other words, black people. Obama said, paraphrasing Romney, that's what he thinks this was all about. I mean, now, think about Mitt Romney and think about how likely it is that he said this. It is more than likely that he said it. It's almost impossible to imagine that he couldn't articulate to Obama, like, the only reason why you won it was because you're black. I mean, here's a guy, Mitt Romney, who thought his trip to the White House would have been much easier. And he said this. If only he had a Latino last name or had been born in Mexico, then he would have, of course, had a much easier attempt at the White House, ignoring all the benefits this guy had. Exactly. Candy, Candy, did you hear what he said about Benghazi? Did you hear what he said about Benghazi?
He really turned out the black people.
Yeah. Unbelievable.
You did a mediocre job of turning out sociopathic white people.
Yes.
Yeah, good luck.
So here is a couple other things apparently from this book, because I don't know if I'll read it. This is Mayor Mike Bloomberg basically telling Axelrod what was wrong with President Obama in 2009. On a trip to New York City in 2009, Mayor Mike Bloomberg offered unsolicited advice about Obama's demeanor. You know what his problem is? You have to like people to be successful. You have to connect, Bloomberg told Axelrod. I saw him greet people at the golf course. You probably told him to do it, but he doesn't feel it. You have to have that. To be a success. That's what Mike Bloomberg, giving advice to the two-term president, Obama.
Look at me. I'm totally natural with people. Oh, my God. There's a Puerto Rican on the block. Security details.
Bang,
security.
Bang, 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 bang.
There you go.
If there's anything that really irks me, it's the idea of a checkout counter girl being able to pay for a child's medicine. You see, it's that type of villain.
The time to be polite is on the golf course.
I will give it to you, though, Obama. You sure got the vote out in Milwaukee and Cleveland.
There you go.
See, the thing with the blacks is that they're not too attuned to those subtleties of human interaction that I'm all about. They don't know how to act on the golf course.
It's one thing to be good with the blacks, but if you want to be successful, learn what I'm telling you.
It's right. You got to go in with the full human beings, if you know what I'm saying.
All right.
I saw him at the country club.
The people. Mike Bloomberg.
All right. We got to get on with the show.
All right. You got to sit down and have fun while with people.
Take it easy, guys. Calm down. Now, listen. Tell you that today's version of the Majority Report is sponsored by Igloo.
We use it at Bloomberg.
I don't know if they use it at Bloomberg News, but it's something I've said this before. We could use it here if I had any inkling that Matt and Mike would actually participate in its usage.
You know what your problem is, Sam? No human connection.
That's right. Igloo is an intranet that you can actually use and like. It's a cloud platform that can help you do your best work. You can share files, blog updates, coordinate calendars, manage projects. It's easy to use and easy to configure, even for the most non-technical of users, which, of course, Michael aspires to have that level of technical
and
use.
Succeeds.
It has an incredibly responsive design, and everything you can do at your desk, you can do on your phone. So Igloo is something you're going to like whether you're a large enterprise stuck using SharePoint. I've never had to use that, but we've already gotten emails, multiple emails saying SharePoint, whatever it is, sucks. So I feel bad for – I mean, people really seem like they're oppressed by it.
Sounds like Igloo is the service for the people.
There you go. Or a fast-growing business overwhelmed by apps, you can create an intranet that matches your brand's look and feel, simplify how you work, and again, like I say, accessible on your phone. Go to igloosoftware.com/majority. That's igloosoftware.com/majority, and try it for free now. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to David Dayan. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is always a pleasure to welcome to the program. He writes for just about every single publication that is worth reading, from the New Republic to Salon to Fiscal Times to the what is the Pacific Standard. I don't know how you do it, but I go to his Tumblr site every day to see what he is where he has written around the internets on any given day. It is, of course, David Dayan. Hello, David.
Hello. I still have yet to be asked to write for MajorityReport.fm. I'm sitting here waiting, but offer has not been made.
You know, I'll tell you what. Let me give you some advice from Michael Bloomberg, apparently. You got to have some people skills. You got to greet people on the golf course. There we go.
You go to the Hamptons.
I'm sorry. We were just reading the some excerpts, I guess, from David Axelrod's new book, and we were trying to figure out who's the bigger a-hole. Is it Mitt Romney or Michael Bloomberg? And it's really tough. It's
down to the wire.
It is really down to the wire. They may actually both have to run for something one more time.
Also, who's more delusional? I mean, that's the other aspect.
They both have their own delusion, but at least I guess.
And what do they share in common? They're extremely wealthy people who have probably a lot of yes men around them.
So indeed.
That's what happened.
Indeed. In fact, I think, you know, Mitt Romney actually sired like six of them, right? Just to be around him and. You're the greatest, Dad. Thanks, Tag. All right. So, all right. Let's move on.
Why you're in this world?
Yeah, exactly. Your mother and I were struggling with only $400,000 in stock portfolio when we had you. All right, so let's move on. So, David, you had a couple pieces out about the budget. I want to start with what's happening with, I mean, in one of the, you know, President Obama's budget has come out, and it is a lot better than his previous ones. And before we get to that, and to some elements of it that I know that you are also critical of, let's talk about what is at least making this push against austerity. And part of it is maybe that President Obama has nothing to has no election facing him. But part of it is also coming from the Senate and Bernie Sanders. Tell us what's happening with Bernie Sanders, because Stephanie Kelton's been a guest on this program multiple times, and this is a pretty big deal, her new position.
Yeah, so Stephanie Kelton was made the chief economist for the minority in the Senate Budget Committee. Bernie Sanders this year became the ranking member of the Budget Committee. So if you think about who has led the Budget Committee on the Democratic side, you went from Kent Conrad, who, you know, was kind of right at the heart of the deficit mania in over the last several years. And now you got Bernie Sanders there. So that's a big enough shift.
Yeah, wait, how does that happen? I mean, because, that seems to be pretty dramatic. I mean, because at one point—
Well, I mean, it happens because of seniority, right? I mean, that's the way that you move up through the ranks and become the ranking member. Now, actually, Patty Murray was in between there, and she was the ranking member and actually leader of the committee when Democrats held the Senate. But I believe she went off to, part of the leadership and gave up the chair to Bernie Sanders. And Bernie Sanders has hired people like Stephanie Kelton. She hired Matt Stoller, actually, I believe has been on the show as well. And a lot of really interesting progressive types who have really changed, or are at least trying from their position in the minority, trying to change the conversation around budgets. Now, if you've had Kelton on, you know that she's a proponent of this modern monetary theory, which is this idea that you know, essentially that governments that print their own currency can't run out of money. And that the real constraint on additional spending is inflationary pressures, which don't exist really at the moment.
And we should say that the inflationary pressures that she talks about is not a function of printing too much money, but when the real economy, the economy itself, becomes overheated and you just have simply too much demand for supply of real goods.
Exactly. When we run out of resources, essentially, and we're certainly nowhere near that point when you have, you know, millions of people still not even in the labor force and you have this below trend growth. So the idea is, what do you do at that point? Well, you want to increase spending, because spending equals GDP. I mean, your gross domestic product and spending aren't really that different. And the way that government can help that is by, you know, using fiscal policy to keep spending. So Sanders dropped a $1 trillion five-year infrastructure bill that broadens sort of the idea of infrastructure. When we hear about it in, you know, the surface transportation bill, that's really just roads, bridges, and mass transit, and that's it. Sanders' bill includes water systems, it includes interstate rail, it includes broadband, it includes airport infrastructure, it includes a whole wide variety, so it kind of broadens out what you mean by infrastructure. And as I said, it spends $1 trillion over 5 years, and it does not have a pay for. There is no offset that has been put out in the bill that says, okay, we're going to fund this infrastructure bill with these tax changes or whatever it is. That does not exist. And this is sort of a function of an MMT mindset. And Sanders himself has said there are other deficits out there. Yes, we have a budget deficit, but there's also a wage deficit which we've had for 35 or 40 years in this country in terms of stagnant wages. There's an employment deficit when you look at the labor force participation rate and how it's been mired as sort of at record lows for the last several years since the financial crisis and the Great Recession. There are all these deficits, and there's a huge infrastructure deficit in the country. The American Society of Civil Engineers always puts out this study and says, you know, we need trillions of dollars of infrastructure improvements just to get back to an adequate level.
Right.
And of course, we're in a situation right now where borrowing rates are extremely low for the U.S. government. I mean, they can borrow at a rate lower than inflation. So in real terms, you're almost not paying anything to borrow.
And you're almost getting paid to borrow.
You're almost getting paid. And so the thing to do right now, when you're talking about looking at these various deficits, if you can create lots of jobs, and what we know is the last time that we had a surplus in this country was in the late 1990s when we had full employment, or at least close to it. And that is what really fixes budgets. I mean, John Maynard Keynes famously said, you know, take care of the employment situation, the budget will take care of itself.
Right.
When you have more people working, you get more tax revenue from that employment into the Treasury. And of course, Sanders, in his bill, this $1 trillion bill, says it will create 13 million new jobs, and they're good paying jobs. So, there you go. That is sort of the leftward pole of this debate, is saying we don't have to pay for this, quote unquote, pay for this. We can fill the deficit in employment and wages and have that be an improvement to the budget all by itself.
And the interesting thing about this, I mean, obviously it is interesting in and of itself, but really what we're looking at is almost like exhibition season, right? I mean, because a year and a half from now, 2 years from now, it is more than likely that Bernie Sanders is no longer going to be the minority leader of that committee. He's going to be the majority leader of that committee, right?
I mean, he certainly could be.
I'm talking about in the event that the Democrats take over the Senate again. So this is not going to be just there's a lot of other stuff that we're seeing now, which are, you know, we're seeing like sort of watersheds and mile markers and flags planted into the ground, which are more electoral in some respects. You know, we see this where you see the Democratic Party move, sort of strike a populist posture as you're going into elections they want to win. But this is something that is, in the event that the Democrats take the Senate, this is going to actually be a real flag in the ground, which is going to basically move, you know, I mean, think about the difference between Kent Conrad, the markers that he puts down and say, this is the leftward discussion of what we're going to do with the budget. All of a sudden that's moved significantly because you've got Bernie Sanders there.
I think it's already moving. I mean, if you look at the president's budget and the fact that he is calling for a 7% increase in the budget and going above the sequestration limits by $74 billion, it's already kind of changing the debate. And of course, we're not that long. It wasn't that long ago that Dick Cheney famously said that Reagan proved deficits didn't matter. And Republicans have an interest in increasing spending limits, particularly around defense, of course. But they do have an interest in doing that going into an election year. And so, you know, sometimes these conversations just change, and Washington ends up doing something pretty decent, even if it doesn't want to, or if it postures against it. The reason the pay for sort of isn't in there is that they didn't want to get into a political discussion, because as soon as you put a pay for in there, all of a sudden it becomes about that pay for, and you have a fight over that. They're trying to get agreement on the need for drastic improvements in infrastructure. But that kind of becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy in some ways. If after everybody agrees and they don't find a decent way to agree on paying for it, well, then they just drop that.
Right.
So, I mean, that happens, and it can happen, and you see the shifts that are happening. Now, on the other end, and I assume we're going to talk about this, there are other shifts around infrastructure that are not so
right. Yeah, let's actually move to that because, you know, and you mentioned this in your piece about and you call it the new corporate amnesty plan. And you make a good point, right? I mean, we have basically and just to remind people about what, you know, as we enter into this conversation, this President Obama made this proposal. I guess it was yesterday or Monday. It's embedded, Monday. I think, in his budget. Dealing with money that U.S. corporations have made overseas and have basically stashed overseas, waiting for another tax holiday. I want to remind people as we go into this conversation that the reason why this dynamic exists is because Eisenhower, during his administration, wanted to help U.S. corporations expand their businesses internationally. And so they gave them a tax break. And that tax break was you don't have to pay taxes on money you make overseas until you actually repatriate it, as opposed to every whatever it is, March 15th, I think is your fiscal year, you have to file your corporate taxes. So, all right. So with that said, where are we now with the present and where have we been in the past?
Right. Well, what that Eisenhower provision did, particularly recently, is get the accountants going at all these multinational corporations to ask, how can we make it look like a lot of our earnings are earned overseas, even if they are actually earned in the United States? And so you have things like inversions where they cite the headquarters in a different place, or they say that, oh, our patents are in Ireland and we license our patents. And so the U.S. companies license the patents from Ireland, so Ireland is gaining all these revenues, our subsidiary in Ireland, which is a low-tax country. That's an example of how this is done. And so, you know, basically we've built it up to the point where now we have $2 trillion.
And David, let me just make this clear to folks what's going on there, is that the benefit for a corporation is that they are holding off on paying U.S. taxes and waiting for something, right? I mean, that's basically it. That's
they're
why
waiting for something, and they know what they're waiting for. Because in 2004, the Bush administration gave corporations a tax holiday. I would call it a tax amnesty, where they allowed corporations to voluntarily repatriate money at a 5.25% rate, rather than the 35% corporate tax rate. And corporations said, oh, if you just let us do this at a low rate, all this money will come flowing into America, and we will invest, and we will create jobs, and we will do all of this good stuff with this money that is now newly returned to the United States. Well, what actually happened?
Well, wait a second now, David. You're not being fair, because you're not telling us what the name of that act was. It was, in fact, the American Jobs Creation Act of 2004.
There you go.
Okay. So you can poo-poo it all you want. That's the name of it. So surely that's what must have happened.
Well, a report by the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations back in 2009 showed that the top 15 companies that took advantage of this tax holiday ended up cutting a net 20,000 jobs from the United States, and that the mass the wide majority of the money that was repatriated went into executive compensation or dividends for shareholders or stock buybacks. That's
okay,
where the money actually went.
So they got a new butler. They got
this
a new
was
driver.
A real boost to the servant economy.
Right, there you go.
Exactly. So, since 2004, corporations got the hint. Well, we can dodge these taxes. We can use accounting tricks. We can move money overseas, We can borrow money when we need to invest here in the United States. Apple has like $1 trillion overseas, and they borrow money to invest in the United States.
They borrow money. I mean, this is what's really interesting about this, too, that we should keep an eye on, because they borrow money to even do their stock buybacks. And because they're anticipating that this money that again, they're waiting for this next tax amnesty, as you call
exactly.
it, or tax repatriation. And what was interesting in your piece, you talk about Boxer and Rand Paul introduced a bill last week. Tell us about that, because, you know, and you can tell me whether or not, you know, you say that unlike that 2004 corporate tax amnesty or the American Jobs Creation Act, with a major asterisk insofar as it did not actually create any jobs, jobs were lost. You write that repatriated funds could not go to shareholder dividends, stock buybacks, or executive compensation for 3 years, but that doesn't mean that it can't go back into debt service.
Right, and it's fungible. I mean, you know, okay, that money doesn't go to stock buybacks, but a bunch of other money that it was retained earnings then goes to stock buybacks. So, I mean, that's sort of, you know, that's a full employment act for the accountant.
Right. But, all right. So just tell us what the Boxer Rand Paul.
Yeah. So Boxer Paul is another repatriation tax amnesty. It's a slightly higher rate. It's 6.25%. The big difference between this and the 2004 bill is that the actual tax revenue that is gained from this money coming back and the 6.25% rate is directly earmarked to the Highway Trust Fund. And the Highway Trust Fund is the bill that's authorized every few years for surface transportation. That's for roads, bridges, and a little bit for mass transit. And it's always short, or at least it has been recently, since we haven't raised the gas tax, which is the primary source of funding for the Highway Trust Fund, in over 20 years. And, of course, cars are more efficient. People are spending less money at the pump. And so there's this tremendous shortfall in the Highway Trust Fund. So this would plug that shortfall using this amnesty, this corporate tax dodge that is being allowed, taking that money and putting it in for infrastructure. The two have nothing to do with each other. I mean, there's nobody that says, well, all corporate tax money on foreign earnings has to go to infrastructure. They're linking it because Democrats want infrastructure projects to go forward, and Republicans want a nice tax break for multinational corporations, and you put the two together and voila.
So there you have it. And so that is Boxer and Rand Paul's idea, I guess. Tell us what the president has suggested. And and also, just do me a favor, just your phone sometimes is it sounds like you're walking in and out of a tunnel, and I don't know remember what Michael Bloomberg said, but that's not appropriate.
Okay, I'm sorry. So the president's budget included a broad corporate tax reform, but the first step of it looks substantially like Boxer Paul. It would be a one-time transition fee. That would actually, instead of being voluntary like Boxer Paul, it would be mandatory. In other words, all the $2 trillion that's parked overseas would get taxed. You wouldn't have to wait for the corporation to bring it or repatriate it back into the United States. And it would be taxed at a 14% rate, which is, of course, twice as much, over twice as much as Boxer Paul, but 60% less than the actual corporate tax rate of 35%.
And I want to make something else clear about that. My understanding is that the way this works is you pay the tax rate in the country that you made it, and then so anything left over, and that basically functions as a credit against the tax rate. So if you're paying already a 14% tax rate in Germany, let's say, I don't know, I think Ireland is 11% or 12%. You're really only responsible as that corporation for the extra 2% at that point.
That's correct, and that's something that isn't really well told, is that we give credits to U.S. corporations on foreign tax paid.
So you're not really paying two separate taxes. You're paying one tax.
Paying
that
float.
Is the
you're paying the float between one and the other.
Right.
Yes.
Exactly.
And right now you're paying the float. You're getting money, right? Because you're not paying anything until you repatriate the funds, and so you can just leave them there indefinitely. And by the way, when this money is stashed away, it's not under a mattress. You can invest that money overseas. In fact, Apple and several other corporations have this money invested in U.S. treasuries, and they earn interest from the government for dodging taxes. The U.S. government is paying money to Apple to borrow money from them that they have stashed overseas to avoid U.S. taxes.
That's right. Unbelievable.
So, just to get back to the president's budget. Now, the second part of the president's budget plan is that you would permanently put a 19% rate on foreign profits, and it would be a global minimum tax, basically. You wouldn't have to repatriate it to have to pay. You would just have to pay at the 15th of the month or whatever you said. And it would include restrictions on these accounting tricks and tax avoidance and things like that. And that money coming in would be used to lower the overall corporate tax rate to 28%, 25% for manufacturing companies. So that's the overall plan. But remember, we have two separate parts here. The one is the near-term thing of the Highway Trust Fund. And by the way, the Obama plan, the one-time transition, that money does get funneled into infrastructure projects, just like Boxer Paul. So you have this Highway Trust Fund. That the authorization of that expires on May 31st. So we have a few months to figure out how they're going to reauthorize the Highway Trust Fund and what money they're going to use to fund that. And then you have this long-term conversation about corporate tax reform, which could take years and years and years and years.
Right. So
can't you see Congress saying, all right, we'll do this one-time transition, and then we'll put off that corporate tax conversation to another time. And essentially what Obama says is a one-time transition functions as a holiday.
So in other words, what you're saying is that on some level, this entire proposal by the president is essentially a Trojan horse, or could end up functioning as a Trojan horse to basically, because now the debate is, do we give a 21% break on a taxed amnesty for these corporations? Or do we give them a 28% break on 29% break?
Now you're just haggling over the price.
That's right.
I mean,
how much of a tax break are we going to give them to repatriate?
Right.
And what it creates is the exact same incentive for them to continue to do them, by mean the corporations, because they know during a Republican administration, they can repatriate with 5%, with a 5%
right.
tax obligation. During a Democratic one, it may be as high as like 14%, but it's probably going to land somewhere in between, maybe a 10%.
Right.
That's basically what's going on.
Exactly. It signals to corporations that they can continue their strategy of dodging payment of taxes on foreign earnings and money that is earned in the U.S., but they, through accounting, push into a foreign country, and that they'll be rewarded through their power and influence. At some point, they'll be able to bring that money back at a low rate. You effectively are permanently lowering the corporate tax rate, and by a lot, by the way, because it's just a clear signal to companies that it's business as usual, and you can always sort of get bailed out by Congress somewhere down the road.
And since you can borrow against that money, it's basically, the notion of whether or not you can repatriate is really just more of an inconvenience than anything else.
It's means that you can't use it for the terms of executive compensation or buybacks or dividends or things like that. But you can still use it for a lot of different functions, including making money from the U.S. government. So
right.
And also you can use it for investment in foreign countries in a way that you can't in the U.S. So when and the Joint Committee on Taxation has looked at this and said, if you do another repatriation tax holiday like Boxer Paul, the U.S. government will end up losing about $100 billion over a 10-year period because more and more money will drain away into these overseas tax havens. And the U.S. won't get the benefit of corporate tax revenue. So you can't pay for infrastructure this way. You're losing money on the deal.
And now
that's the key point.
And with this, with the president's proposal, we basically have seen the parameters of where this is going to land. And that's the,
It's narrowed the debate, even though the president and the White House team has said they oppose a tax holiday. Effectively, what they're giving us is the same thing. And there's two steps, and you can see Congress taking away step two and adding step one and saying, hey, this was in your budget,
yep,
and daring the White House to stop it.
All right. So let's talk about let's move to a slightly different a totally different story that I know is about to. You've got a little bit of news to break here on the show. This is, you know, we don't want to overhype it, but for people who were following this Antonio Weiss, tell us who Antonio Weiss is/was.
Antonio Weiss was the nominee for the number three position at the Treasury Department, the Undersecretary of Domestic Finance, and he got caught up in a very big fight between financial reformers, basically Elizabeth Warren, and the White House, because he was a 20-year investment banker at Lazard. It's a big investment bank. He did international mergers and acquisitions. And Warren's argument was he was not equipped for the position, which is a financial regulatory oversight position, sort of shepherding through Dodd-Frank laws in the Treasury Department. That enough is enough. We don't need more Wall Street bankers setting policy within the administration. And after a couple months of this fight, eventually Weiss left. You see, he withdrew his name for the position, but he did take a position as a counselor to Jack Lew.
Now why would anybody ever want to go through that type of humiliation where you get rejected from the job that you were applying for that needed a Senate confirmation, and then take this sort of like shabby counselor job that probably pays virtually nothing? Why would anyone ever do that, David?
Here's one reason. Actually, here are 21 million reasons. Well, and the reason is that Weiss noted in his financial disclosure form that he stood to make $21 million in deferred compensation from Lazard if he took a position, a senior level position in the U.S. government. And it turns out this is not isolated. And by the way, he probably got that money for being a counselor. We don't know because it's based on a secret agreement, his retirement agreement with Lazard, which we are not privy to. But it's exceedingly likely that he actually made the $21 million. And this is not isolated. In fact, his boss now, Jack Lew, got a $1 million golden parachute from Citigroup when he rotated back into the government.
Just so people understand, we've talked about this. I just want to make it really explicit. Mm-hmm. He had a contract when he joined Lazard that basically was, if I end up taking a job with the government, all of my stock options will immediately vest at that time, and I will get a payout.
It was an acceleration of the vesting of those payments. And at Lazard, it's on a case-by-case basis, but at four banks, Citigroup and Morgan Stanley, J.P. Morgan Chase, and Goldman Sachs, it's explicitly written into their policies, according to their SEC disclosures, that if a top executive takes a position with the government, their stock options will vest, or they will get retention bonuses that they would normally lose if they gave up and left the company. They would automatically get those retention bonuses and be able to keep them. Or in the case of Goldman Sachs, they get a lump sum payment upon leaving for government service. So, you know, the AFL-CIO in particular has called these golden parachutes for government service, and you can see what it would do. I mean, this is an incentive to seed a bunch of different top Wall Street executives within the government where they set policy, presumably, that's pretty friendly to the government. After all, they're making more money from their Wall Street bank than they would be from the government. Who are they actually working for is the real question there. So the AFL-CIO.
And hold on, let me just say one more thing here, too, that mm-hmm. I think, like, you know, the key here for, I think, for people to understand is that for a guy like Weitz or any of these people, it's not a quid pro quo. It is a situation where, like, you're that type of guy. Like, you get the bonus because you have that worldview, that the world that you have come from, the Wall Street world, is in fact the physics of that world are the physics that apply to all worlds in some way. And so it is really, you're just of that ilk, and we reward our own. So you go into government, we don't have to promise you another $20 million when you get out, although if you want it, it'll probably be there. But we don't have to do that because you're one of us, we're one of you, and we do what we do, right? I mean, that's basically what this is.
It's about loyalty.
Yeah.
It's about loyalty. They were loyal to you. They let you keep your bonuses. They let you keep your stock options. They took care of you, and now you're in a position to take care of them.
And people should understand, it's not like he has a part of him that's going like, this is wrong, but I'm going to do it anyways for the money. No, it's like, this is the air I breathe. He doesn't even contemplate it. This is just who they are.
So the AFL-CIO looked at this, and they're shareholders as part of their public pension fund. They're shareholders in a lot of these big banks. And what they did is they dropped a shareholder proposal that would get voted on at the annual meeting. And all this proposal said was, we're shareholders. You're paying these executives to leave the company and go into the government. We don't know how that benefits us. So what we want to know is exactly how much money, who are the people that you have these agreements with, and how much money are they due to receive upon leaving the company for government service. So it was just a disclosure proposal. And what I've found out and what has happened over the last few weeks is that of the four banks that have explicit policies around this, Citigroup, Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs, and J.P. Morgan Chase, three of them, everyone but J.P. Morgan actually, three of them have filed with the SEC what is called a no-action letter, saying that they want to exclude those proposals from a vote at the annual meeting. Wow. And they have various reasons why they want to exclude those proposals. They're all very similar to one another. And the no-action letter process is actually quite bizarre, and I go into it in the piece, which will be up at the New Republic fairly shortly, I believe. But the point is that, you know, these are just proposals for disclosure. We want to know what senior executives are due these awards with shareholder money when they rotate out of Wall Street and into the government. And these banks don't want to give up that information.
Well, let's do this. There we go. I just broke that news. Now, why is it? Why does J.P. Morgan Chase? They don't seem to have a problem with it.
From what this isn't in the piece, but from what I've come to understand, they often work with institutional investors before the annual meeting and go over things and sort of ask what the concerns are, and they. You know, they haven't dropped any no action letter yet, but the potential is that they might change their policy.
There you go.
So we'll have to see what happens and what transpires there. But certainly Citigroup is not changing the policy, or they don't want to. They don't even want to let you know who benefits from the policy. And it's the same with Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs.
Well, David Dayan, as always, thanks for walking us through these three and not unrelated stories. Antonio Weiss was one of those guys who basically helped, in some respects, U.S. corporations, you know, find some profits overseas that they could
Absolutely.
Hold over there. That was his
Absolutely.
Big...
You have to be a people person.
Yeah, there you go. You have to be a people person. Always shake the hands and mean it, David, when you're on the golf course, please. All right.
I will do.
You'll find that, that you'll find that maybe some of those banks will be nice enough.
You have to feel the inversions. You can't phone it in.
You will have to, you might find that some of those bankers might provide you with some of the information you want if you just shake their hands like you mean it on the golf course.
I feel like I'm in a morning zoo that I've never been in, never heard before.
Right, I know.
It's the inside joke is unfamiliar to me. But,
right.
No,
it's we're just making fun of a quote from Michael Bloomberg that was in that David Axelrod. David Axelrod wrote a book that apparently
he said you have to be a people person.
He said something. He basically Bloomberg, apparently, when Obama came to New York in 2009. Gave some unsolicited advice to David Axelrod that President Obama has to look like he really wants to greet people on the golf course. That's the way he can become a success.
I could see an entire symposium at Davos about that.
Indeed.
How to greet people on the golf course, a two-hour study from Mike Bloomberg and Tom Friedman.
Yeah, exactly. I love how our morning zoo – our version of Morning Zoo is all about inversions and tax repatriation.
It evolves into a Davos joke.
Yeah, exactly.
It's hey, it's wacky. It's about the inversion specialist. There he is.
That's right. And we have just this fart came right from the World Economic Forum. All right. All right, David. Always a pleasure. Thank you so much. We will link to your Tumblr site. So people should go there every day because literally nobody produces more stories that than you on a daily, weekly basis. It's crazy.
Thank you very much.
Daily slash weekly. All right. Thanks, David.
Bye.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And David, you should be listening. I should have told this to him. But if he wants to publish on the acclaimed Majority.fm site, he should be listening to the first part of the show. Like,
frankly,
you know.
Morning Zoo.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, frankly, I'm a little bit offended, to be honest with you.
Oh.
Yeah.
Wicker, 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 wicker. I don't even know what that. All right, folks. Hey, just a reminder. This show relies on two things for its success. One, of course, is shaking hands at the golf course, which we do all the time. And in fact, we're heading out there after this afternoon to go shake some hands. And the other is your support. So if you can, if you have the financial resources to become a member of the Majority Report, please do. You can show your support by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. Jointhemajorityreport.com. Or you just head over to majority.fm, click on Become a Member. It's pennies a day, ladies and gentlemen. And as a thank you, we give you an extra 50 minutes, usually more, material every single day, practically. So become a member. Of course, also justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. You know, it actually occurred to me for the first time ever in 4 years to tweet it out last night. I was like, wait a second. I don't have to just say it on the podcast. Every now and then I can make a tweet. And so if you use the coupon code MAJORITY, you know what's inspired me? Film Guy Matthew. Because I don't know how to turn off my Facebook notifications, which I never use Facebook. And I complained to Nikki about it. She looked, and Matthew had a five-pound bag of the Majority Report blend. And I realized, like, wait a second. We can use social media to promote this. So 10% off using the coupon code MAJORITY, and you can get a Majority Report blend. You can get a five-pound bag or 1 pound or I think a two-pound. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. And also, if you buy crap from Amazon, buy it from our Amazon link, for God's sakes. Jesus. Shh. MajorityReportKickback.com. Speaking of God's sake, in the funner half today, we are chock-a-block. Chock-a-block. We got Tom Tillis promoting the fecal hands policy that he wants to push. We have something surprising about that Carnival cruise ship ad that I was offended by. Then we have sound from June Griffin, who is from the Cumberland Missionary Society. She gave the opening prayer for the Tennessee Senate just, I guess it was yesterday, and bat crap crazy. I'm sorry. I don't like to make fun of people. I do. But, I mean, it's not – I don't know. There was something like – it did not occur to me how much I wanted to mock her when I first heard the audio. And then, as I predicted, ladies and gentlemen, remember what I was saying? What was this, yesterday or 2 days ago? Yes. It was just a matter of time when they pivot from you shouldn't get vaccinations because the government overreached to it's really the brown people's fault, period. That's why we have this problem.
You got to identify what people's passions are. Jeffrey Epstein, as an example, runs a pyramid scheme and he likes sex slaves. Ask him about his passions. That's how you get ahead in life. You tell that uppity president of yours all about it.
Hello, Steve. How's the ladies? Or girls?
Hey, Jeff. Any new 14-year-olds you need flown in from Romania? I have a shipment of caviar coming in. See, that's the common touch that the people want.
There you have it.
And then we've got Steve Malzberg. Oh, God, I can't.
There's a lot in the fun half. Stay with us.
Yes, thank you. All right, we'll be right back. The number is 646 257-3920, 646-257-3920. Of course, you can IM us at ladies and gentlemen, through our app at majorityapp.com. Pick up the app. It's free. Or you can IM us through AOL Instant Messenger, whatever your client is, at Majority FM. The number is 646-257-3920. This is a great time to keep an eye on the host going like this over and over again. To start the music. That's basically towards the end of the show. That's what you want to be doing.
Say to the blue page.